Well, this takes me back, this sharing time, to some 40 years ago when I was asked to launch a new class here at the church, and they were encouraging me to make it a class for college students and young career people. I said, no, we want to be intergenerational. So I'm glad that that was actually in the statement. That, by the way, I'm much too old to be working with college kids, and so... One of the reasons I wanted to be intergenerational so that I could keep teaching this class as I got older and older. So that also takes me back in terms of what I want to share with you today to, 50, 60 years ago. Some of you know I've been a serious student of astronomy since I was 7. And whenever there was a really momentous discovery that was being made in the astronomical community, they would send out a telegram to all the different astronomy departments in the world. Well, they still do that. In fact, I got what's here called the Astronomer's Telegram. Only it's no longer a telegram. It's an instant email notice that goes out to all the astronomers. And no, it's a telegram. Well, it's basically an email. But it's reserved just for those discoveries where astronomers around the world need to be able to respond to it immediately. So it's rarely used, but it was used just a couple of days ago. An update came in just this morning. And it concerns this thing here. And before I jump into it, any idea what this is all about? Did you look at this? Yes? It's a gravitational lens. Well, we got some sharp people here in the class. And what is a gravitational lens? What does that mean? Right. What is a gravitational lens? Anyone?
Gravity.
Yes. See, the young people are all jumping in. I'm so glad this is an intergenerational class.
You know how much gravity there is.
All right, go.
Affecting light as it comes to you from a distant planet or star.
Very good. So thank you for the young people in the class. Now for your older people. Okay. Who was the first one who talked about a gravitational lens and actually measured the impact of a gravitational lens?
Isaac Newton?
Wasn't Isaac Newton, no. Yes.
Einstein's the one that proposed it, but he's not the one that measured it. I think that was Hubble, right?
Yeah, Einstein actually proposed that this would be an effect of his theory of general relativity.
I think Hubble was the one that discovered it?
Hubble was not the one that discovered it. Actually, somebody before Hubble.
Van Allen?
No, it wasn't Van Allen. We're talking about somebody who's really long gone. So, you older people. Okay, ever heard of Sir Arthur Eddington? In his day, he was considered the most famous scientist alive. He's a British mathematical physicist. And as soon as Einstein published his theory back in 1917, in 1918, he said, it's actually possible to test one of his predictions. Because one of Einstein's predictions is that a strong enough gravitational source would actually bend the path of light. And Sir Arthur Eddington said, well, we should be able to see that in a solar eclipse. And so he actually mounted an expedition to go to Brazil to observe the 1919 solar eclipse. So we're talking just a couple of years after Einstein's theory got published. By the way, it was a few days ago that celebrated the 100th anniversary of Einstein announcing his theory of general relativity. It was given before the Prussian Academic Society back in 1915, late in December. So if you missed that day, very important day, when he gave the lecture. His paper wasn't yet published, but he gave a lecture to the Prussian Academic Society Academy, where he was basically outlining his theory. It was given in German, of course. And then it got published in German a few months later, and then it was available in English shortly after that. But it was Sir Arthur Eddington who said, we can actually, and it was the first prediction of general relativity that was actually put to the test. And so Sir Arthur Eddington went with a bunch of astronomers down to Brazil. And what did they see? They actually were able to see that the positions of the stars right next to the sun actually were different because of the influence of the theory of general relativity. So instead of the stars, and see, when we get a solar eclipse, you can actually see stars right next to the sun. and they weren't in the positions they would be unless the theory of general relativity was actually bending the light. And Sir Arthur Eddington was able to confirm that the predictions of general relativity were accurate to within about 10%. Okay, but what has happened today is that we're now using gravitational lensing to distant, to view extremely distant galaxies. And so it's a way to up the power of our telescopes. And so what you see here is a cluster of galaxies. And a cluster, and you know, there are some clusters of galaxies that are very different than the cluster in which we live in. We live in the local group, and the galaxies tend to be far apart and not very big. But most clusters of galaxies, you've got these supergiant galaxies, and by the way, there are galaxies that are 1,000 times bigger than our Milky Way galaxy. And our Milky Way galaxy is considered to be one of the bigger galaxies in the universe. But there are galaxies that are 1,000 times bigger. And most clusters of galaxies, the galaxies are jammed tightly together. And so this cluster of galaxies has so much mass, it can actually bend the light coming from a distant galaxy around it and actually focus it so you can actually see that it's brighter. So what we see here is a galaxy being imaged that's so far away you wouldn't be able to see it unless you had the benefit of this lens between us and that distant galaxy, magnifying and focusing the light so that our telescopes here on Earth could actually see what was going on. Now, astronomers have been using this technique for over 20 years. But here's what's brand new. What they discovered back in 2014, October of 2014, I think that's the right date, no, November. November in 2014, this very distant galaxy, and it's located about 8 or 9 billion light years away, and that they found a supernova in it. Now, typically, a supernova can't be seen at that distance. It's just too far away. But because of the gravitational lens, they were able to see the supernova eruption. And it became visible in November of 2014. However, not all gravitational lenses are perfect. A perfect gravitational lens is where you've got a distant galaxy, you've got a galaxy cluster, and the Earth all in a perfect line of sight. Let me demonstrate this for you. Let's see. Let's go down to here. Here we go. Here we have a near-perfect gravitational lens. And so what happens is the distant galaxy gets lensed so that you actually see a circle around the object that is focusing the light. So that's where it's in a perfect line of sight. You're going to get starlight bent all ways around, and so this point of light that exists behind this massive object that's focusing it puts it into a perfect circle. Now, you only get a perfect circle if it's exactly in the line of sight. Much more typically, you get a broken-up circle. And you see, even in this case, it is broken up a little bit. We got a gap up here, and there are some bright spots. So it's not perfect. I mean, you're never going to get a really perfect one. But it's much more typical, where you simply get a bunch of bright spots around the lensing object. In fact, here you see four spots, and there's a name for this. They call it an Einstein cross. And so if it's slightly off-center, you're going to get this. Or you might only get two of the images and miss the other two. And so this is where it's nearly a perfect lineup. You'll get a cross-like image. And this is the cluster of galaxies that was lensing the light of a very distant galaxy in behind it. And what you see here is what they saw in 2014, November of 2014. However, by analyzing the distribution of mass in this cluster of galaxies and what in the galaxy that existed far away where they saw the supernova, they were able to calculate, if I could go back to this one. Okay. They were able to calculate the different pathways that light from the supernova would need to take. Now, what you'll notice is that some of the pathways are going to be longer or shorter than other pathways. And so, if you know anything about supernova, they're giant stars that consume all their nuclear fuel, and when they reach the end of their nuclear fuel burning phase, they go into a supernova where they literally become billions of times brighter. But the supernova at maximum brightness stays at maximum brightness for a few months only. Okay, now if you've got different pathways, say that the lens goes this way and here takes a shorter path this way, what that will mean is, depending on the mass distribution of the lensing object, you're going to get multiple appearances of the supernova. In fact, they're able to look at this particular pattern. Let me go back over to here. By analyzing the mass distribution of this cluster of galaxies, and where they're able to calculate that the distant galaxy was being lensed, they said, okay, we saw the supernova here. By a different light path, it should have first shown up over here back in 1995. And so what the astronomers did is they went over archival images. But what they noticed is that in no case was there a telescope powerful enough at that time to detect this 1995 image. But that's where they calculated it should have first appeared, back in 1995. Yes?
You are any of the thing, are any of the objects that we can see as a result of gravitational lensing visible to the naked eye, or is this all stuff that you have to have a pretty powerful...
You have to have a pretty powerful telescope, and thanks to the gravitational lens, we can actually see these things with less powerful telescopes. Yeah, you have to use the world's most powerful telescopes to see any of them. And so back in 1995, as we looked over the archival data, we realized, no, we didn't have a telescope focused in the right spot that was powerful enough to pick up the discovery. So it's undetected, but it was predicted to have shown up there. Okay, but here's what's exciting. They also found another spot, this spot down here, where they said it should show up in December of 2015. So back in November of 2014, the astronomers analyzing this saying, we make a prediction that based on what we know about this gravitational lens and the distribution of mass, the supernova will reappear a little more than a year later. And that's the telegram that got sent out. They saw it on December 10th.
Does that mean it will reach the Earth?
Well, the image of the supernova reached the Earth on December 10th. Okay. Now, you say, gee, this telegram, why didn't it go out on December 10th? Well, what happened is the astronomers basically collected data from different telescopes around the world, did detailed analysis, and they were not able to confirm that they actually had the data in place, that it was from the supernova, until just a couple of days ago. And so that's why the telegram went out and says, now we know this is the predicted reappearance of the supernova. And what's exciting is several papers were published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society based on the data back in November 2014 saying it will reappear, and they actually gave a 20-day window, a span, saying it's going to appear within this, 30-day window. And it did. That was basically right on target. Yes?
Is the reason the image moves is because the objects are moving in small amount in relation to each other?
No, it's not the movement. What's happening is you've got the supernova that explodes, and it takes about 5 to 7 months for it to go through its light cycle. However, the light of the supernova is being bent along different paths by the intervening cluster of galaxies. So the fact that it's being bent along different paths means the signal is going to reach the Earth at different times, depending where you look in this region. So the theory of general relativity basically predicts where you're going to see the reappearance and when you're going to see the reappearance. And so this is a dramatic confirmation of the theory of general relativity. It's a test that astronomers have been wanting to make of the theory, and this is the first time we've been able to use what's called a known temporal phenomena, And that's what a supernova eruption is. It's a known temporal phenomena. And by the way, this test was being proposed even 30 years ago. But this is the first time we've actually been able to pull it off. And incidentally, it's not over. There's another spot along here, and reading all the literature on this, I've not been able to find the spot, but there's another spot here that astronomers have determined we're going to get a future reappearance. So about a year from now, we're going to see the supernova again. And, you know, what's wonderful about this is often with supernova, you don't realize what's happening until a supernova is already 2 or 3 months along in its eruption. But now that we have this thing predicted to appear, we can actually catch the supernova erupting right at the very beginning of its eruption. Because we know, hey, we've seen it in the past, we got the tail end of it, but now we can get to see the whole thing. And so what's exciting for astronomers is that the hardest data point for supernova events is getting that first month where it really begins to come up in brightness. When you got something that's predicted, you can actually have all your telescopes trained and say, we're going to pick it up right at the very beginning because we know ahead of time. Yes?
So if you look at that field of view or any random field of view in the sky that's big enough to see these kinds of things, what percentage of the objects that you see would be objects that are lens, the gravitational lens? Is it a real small percentage or is it a whole lot? Or?
Well, the universe is dense enough with galaxies that if you've got a really big, dense cluster of galaxies, high probability is going to be lensing something behind it. And so, yeah, virtually every dense cluster of galaxies that's distant. It doesn't work for the close-up ones, but the ones that are distant, high probability. Matter of fact, probably I haven't actually counted it, but the images I personally looked at, well over half show lensing phenomena.
Wow.
So that's limited to the dense, big, distant cluster of galaxies. In fact, you can go online to the Hubble site and they got a collection of these. But this is the first time we've actually seen a supernova eruption being a lens. And so, and being going along different paths, we can actually see it happening again and again and again.
Yeah.
Yes. And then I'm going to come back to you. Go for it.
How much does this influence or confirm the age of the universe?
Okay, very good. That's where I was going to go next. But before I go there, I want to make sure, did you have a point you wanted to make?
Oh, I had a question.
Yes.
In the scientific realm, you refer to Einstein's theory, you know, of relativity, especially. It's been proven so much to be true. How come it doesn't become a law? We have the law of thermodynamics, first, second, and third. Once Einstein's theories have been proven to such a large decimal point, how come it doesn't get changed to law? Is there any scientific body that decides what's a theory and what's a law, or is it just willy-nilly? Or it troubles me that things that have been proven, are we still call them theories?
Well, okay. In science, we've got hypotheses, we've got theories, and we've got laws.
Right.
There are many theories that we have in physics that are better established than some of our laws.
Yeah, that's probably
and relativity is one of those.
Huh?
Relativity is one of those.
Yeah.
However, the reason why it's not called a law is that relativity actually is competition. There are alternate explanations of reality where up till now they're able to fit in within the myth. So even though we got special relativity confirmed to 21 places of the decimal, general relativity to 15, you've got things like modified Newtonian dynamics, for example, that are very close to predicting what general relativity predicts, but are slightly different. And so that's one reason why it's referred to as a theory. But yes, I would say this. Of all the principles we study within physics, the one that's most exhaustively tested and best proven is the theories of special and general relativity. Now, there's another reason why it's referred to as a theory. It's because of the theological implications. Okay?
Well, there's no logic there. It has to go into the emotions. Yes.
And because of general relativity, we realize the universe has a beginning. because of the space-time theorems, we realize there must be a causal agent beyond space and time that created the universe, which is why astronomers and physicists have spent so much time trying to disprove relativity, because the disproof would basically give us a different theological picture. And by the way, there are astronomers and physicists who are Christians that are eager to prove it. And so they're basically working and saying, let's see if we can push the proof a little bit further. And this is one of those examples of pushing the proof a little bit further. So this is great for the Christian faith because it establishes, once again, that the theory of general relativity is secure, and therefore the implications of the theory of general relativity are secure, including what the Bible says about the origin and history of the universe. Another example, the Bible said it first, but now astronomers are confirming what the Bible said. But Mark brought up the point. What does this say about the age of the universe? Well, it was a couple of years ago at the National Conference of Christian Apologetics that I did a debate with Jason Lyle of the, at that time, he was with the Answers in Genesis. He's now with the Institute of Creation Research. He's an astronomer, and he is well aware that one of the biggest challenges to the young Earth paradigm is distant starlight. I mean, if you've got a star or a galaxy that's billions of light years away, and if the velocity of light is finite and unchanging, then that proves that the universe must be billions of years old. And so young Earth creationists have been very active trying to come up with some explanation. How do you get this distant galaxy, the light of that distant galaxy, getting to planet Earth in just thousands of years if it's billions of light years away? You know, one example is to say, well, maybe the velocity of light was faster in the distant past. But that doesn't work because we can actually measure the velocity of light when it left that galaxy. And it's the same that we measure now. And matter of fact, it's part of the anthropic principle. If you change the velocity of light any time in the history of the universe, it eliminates the possibility of life. So the fact that you're sitting here is proof that the velocity of light didn't change. In fact, I debated another young Earth creationist who was really trying to push that view. And I said, well, do you believe in E equals MC squared? And he says, yeah, we all believe in E equals MC squared. That's been proven. There's no basis for doubting that. That's special relativity. What's been proven to 22 place the decimal. I said, well, C is the velocity of light. E is energy, and M is mass. And that principle applies to the sun. And so we have the sun producing energy as a result of converting mass into energy. And so if you're going to claim that the velocity of light at the time of Adam and Eve was a million times faster than it is for us today, that means the energy output from the sun at the time of Adam and Eve would be a trillion times greater. And if it's a trillion times greater, then Adam and Eve would have been incinerated along with the rest of the earth. And clearly that didn't happen. However, in my debate with Jason Lyle, he says, I agree with you, Hugh. All these explanations for how distant starlight gets here fast don't work. So he came up with a new one. And his new one was this one, where he basically hypothesized that the velocity of light as it travels from galaxies and stars towards planet Earth is infinite, and therefore it gets here immediately, whereas the velocity of light that leaves the Earth towards these distant galaxies and stars is half the velocity of light. Now, what he was taking advantage of is that all of our measurements of the velocity of light are limited to measuring the return trip of the velocity of light. It's not possible for astronomers or physicists to measure the one-way path of light. Now, we always assume that it's the same in all directions. And so that's been the assumption of physics all along. But Jason Lyle is correct. It is an assumption. It's an assumption we've not been able to prove. And so he was basically saying that the isotropy or the anisotropy of light's velocity is a convention. He was correct about that. But in a debate with him, I said, what you're saying is correct. We simply, it's a convenient convention that we assume that the velocity of light going out is the same as when it comes back. But I also made the point that directionality is not a convention. The directionality has an impact. So I said you'd be in good grounds if you were to say in this spot the velocity of light is infinite coming towards us but not away from us. But in your model, you've got to make that work in all directions. And here's the problem. Directionality that focuses only on planet Earth would generate a geocentric gravitational field independent of Earth's mass. And this is a principle of general relativity. That if you've got a massive body, it bends space curvature around it. That's why you get this gravitational lens effect. Because a massive body is bending the space fabric around it. And if you're bending the space fabric around it, in effect, what this does is give you the equivalent of a gravitational field focused on the center of the Earth. And if that were really the case, we'd be able to see it. We don't. So the fact we don't see it, I gave as a refutation of his model that the velocity of light was infinite coming towards the Earth. But he protested and said, I want a direct demonstration that this is the case. Well, this is what you actually get from this. Because notice, we got different pathways for the velocity of light reaching planet Earth. So in his model, you're going to get different predictions of when the supernova will reappear. And what was given in the telegram is a prediction you would get if indeed the velocity of light did not depend on a particular direction at all. And the fact that we're seeing multiple reappearances of the velocity of light is especially damning for the young Earth interpretation, that the velocity of light is different coming towards us and away from us. Yes?
Is gravity a push or a pull when you talk about gravity?
Well, what Einstein was pointing out is that what gravity does, it actually alters the space fabric. Now, here's a good analogy. Think of a stretchy surface like the top of a trampoline. Okay, a massive body like the sun or a cluster of galaxies basically is like putting a really heavy medicine ball on a trampoline. What it's going to do is going to distort the trampoline from being a flat surface to where it kind of bowls in at the point where you got that heavy medicine ball or a heavy human being. That's what makes a trampoline work. You jump on it and it actually distorts the surface of the trampoline. All massive bodies do that.
Would a supernova affect radio and TV communication and internet communication?
It definitely would if you had a star like Sirius going through a supernova eruption, since it's only 8 light years away. But something we talked about in class a year ago is that one of the amazing things of the era in which we live, there hasn't been any nearby supernova eruptions throughout the past 10,000 years. Now, if you go back into the last ice age, there were. But during this era that God has established for us to launch and sustain global high technology civilization, we've not had any sufficiently nearby supernova to cause that kind of a problem. So we've been protected. But I can tell you, looking at supernova data, it is extremely extraordinary that just in the last 10,000 years, there hasn't been a supernova closer than 1,500 light years. Therefore, they've not bothered us at all. Whereas at previous times, there were supernova erupting 100, 200, 300, 500 light years away. Not enough to kill you. 100 light years might. But something that's only 500 light years away wouldn't necessarily kill us, but it would sure mess up our technology. Yes?
How do you respond to the young Earth view that God created all the stars and the light?
In transit?
Yeah.
First time I debated Dwayne Gish, he gave that argument. Young Earth creationists have abandoned the argument, mainly because I've published in books since 1993 why this is a failed argument. That I can actually pull that up for you. Let me see if I can find it here quickly for you. Okay, here we go. And I did this on, I think, Tuesday PM. Let me see if I can find it. Here we go. Took me a little while because I got about 300 keynote messages in my library here. But yeah, your question is actually addressed directly in this one. And for about a 15-year period, young earth creationists, that was kind of their favorite argument. As you'll see in a minute, these are some reasons why it doesn't work. All right, there's some... Unfortunately, this is a 3-gigabyte PowerPoint. So here we go. It's finally up. Ah, here we go.
He's getting a Joan Allison pinch.
Okay. Light as it transits through space, and that's kind of the argument, that God sent the light on its way starting, say, 6,000 light years away. But here's the problem. As light travels through space, it passes through gas clouds. You say, what's the problem with that? The gas clouds move. And because they move this way, and especially this way, they broaden the spectral lines. Here's the other problem. As light travels through space, it's got to pass through dust. What does dust do to the light? Hey, you all live here in Southern California. What happens when you have a forest fire?
It's red.
Yeah. The sun, moon, and stars become red in color. So dust reddens the light. Now, the dust will redden what's called the continuum part of the spectral light that you get. And the gas clouds that are moving relative to us are going to broaden the spectral lines. So, what we do notice is that the spectral lines... we could turn off the lights, you could see this a lot better. The spectral line widths and the continuum radiation. So what we see is, indeed, it gets redder than what it did before, if I can pull this back a bit. Okay, there we go. And so what we see is it's that you've got a narrow line there, and it's not so red. When you actually measure it, we notice that the spectral line gets broader and the continuum radiation gets redder. And so the more distant the galaxy, the more distant the star, the redder the continuum radiation and the broader the spectral lines. And by the way, that was a technique that we astronomers used back in the 1960s. When quasars were first discovered, how they picked them up, they looked for broad spectral lines. Broad spectral lines told them they were looking at something extremely distant. Yes?
Didn't they just say that God created it to look like it had been going through about dust and...
Well, I got that from Dwayne Gish in one of my debates with him. He said, yeah, God just did all that. And I said, well, he's got to do that with hundreds of billions of stars and galaxies. Mm-hmm. And he's got to adjust it to be exactly right for all the different distances. Because you get different reddening for one that's closer than one that's farther away. And it says, what that looks like to me is God spending a huge amount of time to deceive us into thinking that the universe is old when in fact it's very young. And, you know, Dwayne Gish eventually admitted that that indeed is would be a sign of deception on an incredibly large scale, because God would be doing that for every astronomical image. Adjusting the reddening and adjusting the width of the spectral lines for no other reason other than to fool us about its distance and its age. And so the young Earth community dropped this argument. It's one of the earlier arguments that they dropped. And so when I debate young Earth creations today, this one does not show up. But it was very popular, say, even as recently as 15 and 20 years ago. And so, and basically what's happened is, within the young Earth community, it's been broadcast why these arguments don't work. But the latest one is this one from Jason Lyle. And so, And because it involves the complexity of general relativity, it's taking the lay community a little longer to figure out why it doesn't work. And by the way, that's the advantage of this Refstall supernova. That's the name of it, the Refstall supernova, is that it's such a simple thing to understand. Hey, we're actually seeing the supernova erupt at multiple different times in multiple different locations, and that's easily recognized as a refutation of the claim that the velocity of light travels infinitely fast towards the Earth. There was another comment that I saw. Yes.
I'm just thinking that there's an interesting surah in the Quran that says that Allah is a deceiver. And he's evil people. And
Well, you notice that in a number of non-Christian religions. In fact, this is something I've noticed. When I ever talk to a Muslim, I say, have you guys ever heard of Mormonism? And when I talk to a Mormon, have you ever heard of Islam? And it's because of how incredibly similar the two faiths are. They both have a Latter-day Prophet and a Latter-day Book, and the teachings are remarkably similar. And the strategy I'm using here is, if I can let them see that this has happened twice and not once, it makes them question, okay, why is Mormonism wrong and Islam right? Or why is Islam right? And, you know, and the whole point is even this remarkably similar, is that you've got both Muhammad and Joseph Smith being visited by an angel who gives them this message. And what does the Bible tell us this in 1 John? Is that Satan will appear as an angel of light to deceive. But one of the common doctrines in both Mormonism and Islam is that it's okay to deceive people to make them a convert. And so it's considered well within your right as a Muslim or a Mormon to tell lies to non-Mormons and non-Muslims in order to convert them. And yeah, it's actually embedded right in their doctrine, which is a distinction from Christianity. And so one of the things that you need to know when you witness to Mormons and you witness to Muslims, you need to bring them to a point where truth trumps everything. One of the problems you run into with people raised as a Muslim is your family relationships trump truth. But the whole point is the human heart really can't live with that. And so people I know who have come to the Christian faith, being raised in a very tight, loving Islamic home, what they tell me is it usually takes a couple of decades for them to reach that point of frustration where they say, you know what, I love my family, but I got to follow the truth. But we Christians think everybody believes that truth trumps everything. That's not true. It's true for us. And so we often need to help people get to that point. Which, by the way, I think is one of the big advantages of engineering and science education becoming a worldwide phenomenon. What we're seeing in India, especially, is that engineering and science is bringing people to the recognition there's something wrong with Hinduism and something very right about Christianity. Well, we're also seeing that having an impact on the Islamic world.
Have you ever visited the Arecibo campus of the University of Puerto Rico?
I've never been to Puerto Rico. Been to a lot of places, but not Puerto Rico. Okay. But I want to put this in a positive in the sense that this discovery not only refutes a major tenet of a young earth creationism, it sustains a major tenet of the Christian faith in the sense that, hey, general relativity really is an ally and a friend of the Christian faith. Big Bang cosmology is an ally and a friend of the Christian faith. In fact, the Bible predicted Big Bang cosmology thousands of years before any scientists discovered it.
Yep, 9 minutes. Is there anything else you want to get to?
9 minutes. All right. Well, here's what I wanted to spend more than 9 minutes, but we'll at least get it started. I've been doing quite a bit of speaking on seminary campuses, and also at apologetics conferences, and in fact, Reasons to Believe is writing a book with people who are Christians, scientists and seminary professors who take a different view than we do on creation. But I think what's becoming apparent to me is just how pervasive the view within the Christian faith is that Genesis simply cannot be defended from a scientific perspective. And so it's happening on major conservative, not just liberal, but conservative seminary campuses, is basically reinterpreting the early chapters of Genesis in such a way that they're free of scientific content and free of any chronology. And this actually goes back to 1896, where you got Franz de Leesch writing this book, Babel and Bible. So what he says here is that all attempts to harmonize our biblical story of the creation of the world with the results of natural science have been useless and must always be so. Basically saying it's impossible to reconcile what we see in the biblical story of creation. And so he was one of the first to advocate, at least in the modern era, that we need to reinterpret, especially Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. Now, we have been engaging, by we I mean Reasons to Believe, we've been engaging an organization called Biologos, which are, they refer to themselves as evolutionary creationists. And one of their leading spokesmen, in fact, he was the president for a number of years, Daryl Falk, in the book that we're writing with them, has made this statement: Genesis 1 ought not to be taken as a literal historical account of all material reality. Now, one of the problems I have with that is there any other chapter of the Bible that's more clearly written as a chronology of natural events? And so you might say this as a Christian, but you're going to have a hard time persuading non-Christians. I mean, for example, just go to the Skeptic Society, show them Genesis 1, what is this all about? The fact that the days are numbered, the fact that you see, and it was so being repeated, the specificity of what it's talking about in terms of natural events, boy, this sure reads like a chronology. But I was wondering, you know, where did Daryl get this? Daryl is a biologist, a member of the board of directors for Biologos is the very famous pastor and theologian Tim Keller. By the way, I really appreciate Tim Keller's works. I've got a number of his books, one of the outstanding exegetes of our day. But he says this about Genesis. In Genesis 1, natural order means nothing. Why does he say this? There are three evenings and mornings before there is a sun to set. Therefore, how can it possibly be a book about natural history? He goes on, there is light on day one before there are any sources of light. And basically he's taking the position, if you take Genesis 1 to be about literal history, then the sun, moon, and stars don't even exist until the fourth day. He goes on to say, there is vegetation day three, before there was any atmosphere, day four, when the sun was made, and therefore vegetation before rain. So he says, you got a problem here. If you take this as a literal account of history, you got vegetation before there's an atmosphere, you got vegetation before there's a rain, you got vegetation before there's the sun, moon, and stars, you got light before the sun, moon, and stars exist. Clearly, we have to reinterpret Genesis 1 in a completely different way. Now, I've written about this extensively, and the thing that amazes me when I speak about this in university campuses, when I read Genesis 1, it just seems so crystal clear it's not saying any of this. However, the reason why I want to bring this up, my goal over the next few years is to get as many lay Christians as possible equipped to deal with these challenges, because these challenges are being pervasively taught on our leading conservative seminary campuses around the world, and these are all of our pastors are coming from. In fact, I've talked to a lot of young pastors and say, yeah, this is exactly what we were taught in seminary. So we got a problem here. And I think it won't be resolved until lay Christians are equipped to deal with this. So basically, in whatever time I got left, 4 minutes, I'm going to turn it over to you, and we can extend this next time. I'm going to be gone next Sunday, but I'll be back the Sunday following. Is all right? How do you deal with this? And what is the problem? Why are we having some of our leading pastors and seminary professors at leading conservative institutions going down this path? And how do we help them out? Yes.
I mean, clearly, they get the frame of reference wrong. They weren't taught the scientific method, and they don't understand the scientific method, and so they're reading this and getting the frame of reference wrong, which is, you know, right in the second verse.
Well, what's interesting about that, Dave, is that there is a review of my book, Navigating Genesis, published in the Journal of the American Scientific Affiliation, and most of the review was attacking my idea that Genesis 1-2 is establishing a frame of reference for the six creation days. And so he was basically trying to say, you know, the Hebrew word structure doesn't sustain this. This is just Hugh's idea. No one else has come up with it before. But that's simply wrong. It's not unique to me. Lots of people before me and after me have come up with the same same idea. And what Dave is referring to, let me see if I can pull this up here. Here we go. Is this. Genesis 1-2 says the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters of planet Earth. And when I first read Genesis seriously at age 17, I said, that's the frame of reference for the 6 days. Now, this gentleman who critiqued my book just a few days ago in his journal basically says Hugh is reading that into the text from his scientific perspective. And he's got a point. In a sense, all the text says is the Spirit of God is hovering over the surface of the waters. And, you know, his critique was, it says nothing about the point of view. It's just simply saying God is hovering over the surface of the waters. But I can tell you as a young 17-year-old, that seemed to scream to me, that's the point of view from which you were to interpret the 6 days. Now, where I would go with that and where I did go with that in navigating Genesis, this isn't the only biblical text that establishes this as the point of view for the events of creation, of creation events in Genesis 1. You're right. All you got is a few words here. And you could interpret it a different way than I interpret it. But if you actually go to the book of Job, Job 38, 8 and 9, in fact, I think I can pick this up for you as well. Let's see what we got here. Yeah, here it is. This is what we see in Job when it's referring to these events that are described in Genesis chapter 1. It says, I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it in thick darkness. Because what you also see in Genesis 1-2, the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the waters, and it was dark on the surface of the waters. Notice that Job 38 here tells you why it's dark. It's dark because God blanketed the seas with clouds. It's not dark because the sun didn't exist. It's not dark because there is no moon or stars. It was dark because the clouds blanketed the seas and kept the seas dark. And therefore the idea that God didn't create the sun until the 4th day, in my opinion, is a mistaken interpretation. The sun was there in the beginning. The reason why it's dark isn't because there was no sun. The reason why it's dark is because of these clouds. And Genesis 1-2 tells us it was dark before the 6 days. So, principle there being is don't just stick with one text. You've got to look at all the texts.
Before you close in prayer, could you expand on that Hebrew word hover? Other translations use the word brood, because I believe the other place it's used in the Bible is a bird over its chicks. So it's really not like he's sitting like a helicopter over the oceans. That word brood, I think, means that he's actually there.
Well,
nurturing the planet. That word really isn't a good word, in my opinion.
Well, the word is rahab in Hebrew. And it only shows up one other time in the entire Old Testament. It shows up in the book of Deuteronomy, where God talks about how a female eagle will hover or brood over her newborn chicks as a way to nurture them, care for them, prepare them for adulthood. And that's basically used as an analogy in the book of Deuteronomy, where God says, that's what I'm doing with you. I'm hovering over you, I'm brooding over you, to bring you to this point of maturity. I've got plans for you. that are much bigger than where you are right now. And so, but yeah, the fellow who critiqued me basically said, you know, this word Rahab is debated as to exactly what it means. That explains why some passages say hover, other passages say brood. Fuzz Ron and I have made the point that the brooding aspect would actually imply, doesn't say it directly, but implies that the origin of life would be the beginning of creation day one, where God is bringing to life. Because when you look at the 6 days, it's all about God preparing the planet for life and filling it with life. Anyway, we'll pick this up next time. But I've been concerned that for me, what is an obvious interpretation of the text is not an obvious interpretation for people who are pastors, seminary professors. Although I'll tell you this, I've seen numerous seminary professors and pastors have their ministry changed simply by being exposed to this. And by the way, it's not unique to me. In fact, I'll close with this. I was once sharing a taxi cab with Gleason Archer, who, in my opinion, is probably the greatest Hebrew scholar who ever lived. He was a guy who was fluent in 27 different languages. And I said, how did you maintain that fluency? He says, well, I do my devotions in a different language every day. So he told me that he came up with the identical interpretation of Genesis 1 that I did back in 1955. And he said, I did it strictly from the Hebrew, but I didn't dare publish it because I wasn't sure about the science. And so I was speaking on his campus, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, where I was talking about the science. And he says, now that I see the two together, this really makes sense. So let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we do live in a challenging day and age where we're being challenged on all fronts, both within the church and outside the church, about the validity of this text that we call the Bible. And thank you, Lord, that this is a church that believes that the entire Bible is inspired and inerrant, totally trustworthy and authoritative. Father, I pray that you continue to equip each one of us to defend the inerrancy, the authority, the inspiration of this text that we call the Bible. And by that means, Lord, we can give assurance to unbelievers that we know that this is something they can trust as truth from cover to cover, and therefore that this could be a means by which they can gain an eternal relationship with your Son, Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.